The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to episode 67 of The Commentary Track. I'm your genial host, Frank Thompson. You know, one time I shot an elephant in my pajamas. I should clarify that. I was wearing the pajamas when I shot the elephant, not the elephant in my pajamas, because that would be laughable and, I'm glad to say, impossible. And I'm sorry for my syntax. It probably led you astray at the beginning of that story. We got a great one today. A film historian, writer that I've been after for quite a while, Joe Adamson. He's written several books, but two of them have been very important to me over the years. The first one is his study of the Marx Brothers called Groucho, Harpo, Chico, and sometimes Zeppo. And then he wrote a book on Tex Avery, King of Cartoons. Now, my admiration for both the Marx Brothers and Tex Avery are without peer, I will say. And so I read both of these books simply because I was so interested in the subject. But then I became a real fan of Joe's because of his writing style. The Marx Brothers book particularly is almost as funny as a Marx Brothers movie. He writes it with a real comic style, and it's just a real sprightly way of writing a book. And I like it very much. I've always enjoyed this book a great deal. I've been after Joe for a long time to be on this podcast, and he finally couldn't avoid me any longer. He tried. I would just not be put off. So I hope that you will enjoy this conversation with Joe Adamson. You told me that you had a chance to meet Groucho, and this is how it started.
I had the idea, and the idea was not even my idea. It came from a guy named Vin DeBona.
Ah.
And you recognized that name as soon as I threw it out there.
Famous, successful guy.
Don't know how many. I don't know how many people would, but anybody who watches America's Funniest Home Videos has seen that name every time they watch the show. In fact, it's done by DeBona Productions.
Sure.
And Vin loved the Marx Brothers. He was a fellow student at UCLA. I think when I was still an undergraduate, I think he was a graduate student by then, and I think he was from out here, from the East Coast. Like you and me. Vin DeBona loved the Marx Brothers, and we were in the same American film history class. Dr. Howard Suber was teaching it, and we had to do a paper in it, and we both did something on the Marx Brothers. I did the making of The Gold Rush, The General, and Night at the Opera, and kind of paralleled, you know, what they had to go through. I mean, just from what you could have extrapolated in 1966 from the existing literature. That was my paper, but Vin's paper also related to the Marx Brothers, and once we got them in, and we were talking about them all the time, and he's the one who turned me on to the Alan Iles book on the Marx Brothers. Mm. And I was interested that there was a book on the Marx Brothers, but you know, when I read it, I was disappointed in it, very similar to seeing Mad Mad World and saying, well, I would have gone about this differently. I'm sorry. And toward the end of that term, we were not in semesters anymore. That was the first time that we were in 10-week terms, which were called quarters at UCLA at that time. I don't know if they still use that. But in December of 1966, he said to me, you want to interview Groucho Marx? Just a casual idea at the top of his head. And I said, my first thought was, no, God, he'll tear us to shreds. And then I thought, what the heck? So what if he does? This is something to tell your grandchildren. So I went, all right. You know, so we tried to figure out how we could go about it. And he thought Marvin Borowski, who taught at UCLA, would know how we might get hold of him. He thought he might know some of the people who worked for the... No, I'm trying to think why he spoke to Marvin Borowski, and I don't think that was it. but he did find out in speaking to him that Marvin Borowski knew George Seton. Well, you know who George Seton is.
Sure.
The interesting thing is that when I found out about the UCLA Film History Program, what I found out about it was that George Seton had an apprenticeship program where you could follow a production along and attend the meetings and the conferences and watch the shooting, you know, of a film and learn how films were made. And that he was interested in helping film students get into the yeah. industry. That's part of the reason that I came out here thinking it might be a way to get myself into the Hollywood filmmaking. Within months of being here, Ben Barsman's daughter, do you know Ben Barsman?
No.
Do you know the name?
No.
He wrote The Blue Max, but he was one of the...
I know the film, yeah.
He was one of the blacklisted writers. And his daughter, Luli, was one of my friends at school, and she just said to me point blank, "You're not ever going to get into the Hollywood studios by going, doing anything here. This is not going to help you do that." So right away I realized, all right, I've come all the way out here on false pretenses. What am I going to do now? I've got to find something. And it really didn't occur to me when Vin DeBona said, "Do you want to interview Groucho Marx?" that that might be it. But I did have this need to find the project that was going to really begin my professional career. So when Vin DeBona talked to Marvin Borowski, Marvin Borowski said, "Well, you want to get in touch with George Seton." And he's, you know, he knew George Seton from his work with UCLA. So, all right, that sounded good. And the word came, so he called George Seton, and the word came down from George Seton that he wanted to talk to us first. And we didn't know what he wanted to say. But, I mean, all this is coming to me. I never met Marvin Borowski. I did talk to him once on the phone. But, in fact, in the whole process developed, and I never met him. And he's the one who made this connection. George Seton, this is what George Seton is like. He just got interested in the fact that we wanted to interview Groucho Marx. These boys should do it. He didn't know us, you know. And I later found out that this may be in George Seton's file at the Academy Library. It should be, because I read it in the LA Times. They were going to give him some humanitarian award or some industry award. I don't know if it was the Irving Thalberg Award, the Oscar that they give to people for humanitarian work or what. But they were going to give him, it was some award and it was of some significance. And his reaction was, "Don't give this to me. There must be better people you can give it to. Me, what have I done?" And they went, "George, what have you done? You've done this, you've done this, you've done this." And they listed the things that he had done. And he had honestly done these things, but when he did them, he didn't do them with any interest in getting points for himself. He just did them because he could do them, and he thought they should be done. And that was the way he was doing this, you know what I mean? So the story is, anyway, they rattled off all these things he'd done, and his reaction was, "Well, maybe you should give me the award." And he got the award, but, I mean, he should. He just took us under his wing, and... But we didn't know what it was he wanted to tell us, and I ended up going in without Vin. I bought a notebook because I was all intrigued with this project, and I just got this one of these spiral notebooks with 8.5 by 11 sheets in it, and it was blank, and I was just going to take all the Marx Brothers notes there, whatever it was he had to tell us. And I got to his office, and he came in, and, you know, he got a whole suite of offices at Universal, so it was quite something to be there on the lot. He's coming in, "I'm George Seton," and shook my hand, sat down, and he said, "Well, I'm the one with the information and you're the one with the questions, so you just fire away and I'll do my best to answer whatever you got to ask." I didn't have any questions. I just opened this notebook to one of its many blank pages and pretended to read off questions that I was frantically making up in my head as I went, you know. And it really was, my basic question that I've ever asked in any interview was, what was it like to be doing this? What was it like to work with the Marx Brothers on
Sure.
Day at the Races? And that's when I found out they worked with the Marx Brothers on Night at the Opera. They just didn't get a credit.
Yeah. Well,
that wasn't in any book. I mean, I knew he was giving me stuff that was not in the literature, because I knew the literature. I'd read all the Marx Brothers books. And at the end of the thing, he said, let me, he called Groucho, and Groucho put him off. But he said, have him call me in June. Have him call me next month, I think it was. Maybe it was May. Whatever it was, I did call him the next month, and he had no memory of having said this, and he just, you know, put me off again. He just said, I get requests like this all the time, and if I tried to answer all of them, I'd never do anything else. So I just can't. What happens is Groucho plays Groucho up to a point, and if he sees that that's not going to work, and he has some kind of respect for it, he'll level with you. He would. I mean, he's gone now, but I mean, once I got to know him, he did this several times. You know, he would play Groucho, try and come up with a funny answer to anything you said. But then, you know, he would have something, and he's going, blah, blah, blah. And it was definitely man-to-man. And he did that in that first call. He said, you know, please understand, I just can't do this. And there was nothing I could say. So that got me nowhere. But before this session with George Seton was over, he'd given me the phone number for Irving Brecker and Harry Ruey.
Wow.
Two people whose names I had, I guess, read off the screen, but I really wasn't sure. I had to go look them up to really know what they'd done. But Vin and I interviewed Harry Ruby. It was basically Vin interviewing Harry Ruby. And toward the end, he said, I think Joe has some questions. You know, and I got my 2 cents worth in. But, I mean, you know, my learning how to interview show business veterans was a little bit like throwing a guy in the water and calling it a swimming lesson. Oh, sure. It really was. And Irving Brecker was not the easiest person. I did Irving Brecker by myself. He was not the easiest person, but he admired Groucho so much that he had that kind of attitude, kind of. But he was very nice to take the time.
Well, Ruby must have had a bunch of good stories.
Harry Ruby is one of the nicest guys in the world. And I mean outwardly nice. George Seton has a kind of air of self-importance, but he'll do anything for you if he believes in what you're doing. Harry Ruby was just the sweetest guy in the world. And you can hear it on the tape. I think, Vin, one of the first things on the tape is, can I put this down here? Sure, whatever you want. He was standing out in the hall. He was in one of those security buildings, so we were announced, and we took the elevator up to his floor, one of those buildings on Wilshire with many, many floors, and he was standing out in the hall waiting for us as we walked up the hall, and Vin said his name was DeBona, and Harry Ruby said, DeBonafide, and got a laugh from Vin with this. I thought, oh my gosh, this is pretty fast company. But he was super nice and answered our questions and so forth. But yeah, basically for Harry Ruby, it's a series of stories, and he told me the story of the bathrobe, which is in the book, on Animal Crackers, which Maury Riskind also told, and so I was able to put the two versions together for the version that's in there. But he gave us that version of everybody buying a bathrobe until they got to Harry Ruby and then decided that was enough of that. Yeah, in his mentality, it was the stories that were important. Nat Perrin, when I interviewed him, it would be more, you know, well, Groucho is this kind of person. I found him like this. Herman Mankiewicz, he came at it from this point of view, and this was, this other writer, I don't remember him being too much involved with them. It was much more analytical. Yeah. With Harry Ruby, it was a series of stories. He would say, you know, he said, they wanted a hit just like we wanted a hit. But nothing would keep them from doing anything that, well, I'll give you an example, and then He was telling another story. And so that made for good. If you could do it, people like to read stories. And it's like, I think now the production of any film is its own story. Just like I went through Out of His Mind World. I mean, Best Years of Our Lives, Night at the Opera, any of the 2001, any picture you take. How did that come to be? Especially an interesting picture, but even some of the pictures that aren't that interesting, it's kind of...
Yeah. When I write about film, I'm exclusively interested in the process. And I have no interest in criticism or reviews or anything like that. That does not interest me at all. I never read reviews. I want to know how the film was made, what went on, who were the personalities involved. And that's what's interesting to me. What meaning people find in it, I think, is subjective. I don't care. I'm not speaking to you specifically, but I don't care what you think. It doesn't matter to me, you know?
You notice that in The Searcher's book, he talks about the things that meant something to him in the picture, but also why the picture captured the imagination of everybody from Buddy Holly, who made a song out of That'll Be the Day, which comes from that movie, to, you know, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. But also, he's got all the negative comments, including Lindsay Anderson, who was a big John Ford fan. It just didn't work for him.
Lindsay Anderson loved all the films that nobody else who likes Ford likes, and he hated all the films that everybody loves.
So. Really?
Yeah. It's a weird thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know.
Well, it's funny how that works, but that's why, you know, a good writer can make it work. In other words... I think he quotes Pauline Kael, and I think she makes some good points that some of the line readings are really not very good.
Oh. The Search is another story, but they're definitely, it's not a perfect film. I'll go with you on that.
But, it's not a perfect film, but
it's a great film.
Of unquestionable power and influence.
Yeah.
And he makes a case for it being more important than I would have even considered it. But it's my favorite Ford film. It's either that or Long Voyage Home. Now that I've seen Long Voyage Home, that's darn close.
I still think How Green Was My Valley is probably my favorite. And Young Mr. Lincoln
that's
is
good
my
too.
Second favorite. Yeah.
Young Mr. Lincoln was at one time David Shepard's favorite film ever.
I can see it. I can see how that would be. But... How did you finally get to Groucho?
Interestingly, I interviewed Groucho after I finished all this. By the time we'd finished interviewing not only George Seton, but Harry Ruby and Irving Brecker, I had a lot of information and I knew was not in any of the literature. And 1966, December of 66, when all this started, you know, all early 67, these interviews were going on. This was my senior year. I got my BA degree in June, and my parents came all the way out from Pennsylvania to see me get it. And I didn't know what the heck I was going to do with my life. You know, I had been told UCLA was not going to help me get into Hollywood studios. What was I going to do? And there was a war going on. And I was over 18, so... If I didn't stay in school, I was going to be shipped overseas.
Yeah.
And it's not a pretty part of the story. But while I was in high school, my cousin, Jerry, was casualty number 26 or something of the 55,000 American casualties in Vietnam. And, you know, we knew some had died, but it was really a shock. It was a much bigger shock than my grandfather dying. My grandfather died young. He was in his 50s, but he wasn't 25. My cousin Jerry was 25. And my mother had helped take care of him when he was a baby. I mean, this was critical. So I knew I had to stay out of that. And So I applied to grad school, and I was accepted. So now I'm a grad student, and I've got this Marx Brothers thing in my head, but nowhere else. And I thought, I'll bet I could take an independent study course and write this up. I've already done these interviews. The interviews were completely extracurricular. You know what I mean? I had courses I was taking then I still had to satisfy. But we had enough, we somehow wedged in enough time to get these interviews done. And it had nothing to do with what was going on at that time. I mean, in other words, there was such an anti-Hollywood atmosphere at UCLA when I got there. The idea that I was going to go from there to the Hollywood studios and do anything, you know, was just the most far-fetched idea. By the time I got my MA degree in 1970, you know, Andrew Saras's American Cinema had come out, and people were talking about, you know, a major von Sternberg film or an early von Sternberg or a late Hitchcock. And, you know, American films were much more to people's liking, but still. Oh, and Francis Ford Coppola had since then now made You're a Big Boy Now. And when he made You're a Big Boy Now, he had been a graduate student and had done everything except his thesis film. He made You're a Big Boy Now and came back and said, this is my thesis film. And he got his degree.
Wow.
So, smart. So there was such a thing as going from film school into the business. So I thought I could maybe get 3 credits for writing up this Marx Brothers thing. I started to do it and realized this is not 3 units. This is 6 units. I'm going to have to take independent study in the fall and the spring. But I was accepted for independent study, and I said, is there any way I could see the films? You know, is there a budget for me to rent films and look at them? There was no budget. I was completely on my own. So I had to just scrounge it together. Well, I started writing, and I started writing that book from the middle. And if you know the book, you know that I considered the 5 major films, Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, Duck Soup, Night at the Opera, Day at the Races. That was the core of the book.
Sure.
And the films before that and the stage work, I was going to do something because I knew what had happened there and that was a part of the story. But that wasn't nearly as important as Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, and Duck Soup. And I started on Night at the Opera, and I figured I'll turn in that part first, and then in the spring I'll do the marginal stuff. And boy, you know, I worked those 10 weeks, and at the end of 10 weeks, I had 40 pages on Night at the Opera. I never got past Night at the Opera. So I submitted that to Howard Suber, who had been my professor for that American film class that had started all this. And, you know, very simply, he flipped. And he said, I mean, what he said was comparable to what I wanted to hear every time I made a film there. I wanted people to go, this is great. We're going to put you in this program and you're going to get honors. And I mean, I was an honor student all through high school and into college. You know, I was I got straight A's my first term at, first it was a semester at UCLA. And none of that meant anything to me because it wasn't getting me any closer to making Hollywood films. And so I was really trying to get some kind of honors, you know. I wanted to get excitement over the films I made. I would make films and people go, okay, pretty good. What's, your film ready yet? Let's thread that one up. Was not getting the reaction I wanted. Well, Howard said, this is great. This is great. You've got to finish this. And I'm sure we can find a publisher for you. So I was going to write a book and it was going to get in print. Now this put me on more of a track than I was ever since Lulie Barsman had said, you're never going to get in Hollywood studios from this place. Yeah. Now I had this gave me direction in my life that I hadn't had since I had had for a long time. I was really drifting. And that was December of 1967. And he just said every term, we're now on these 10-week quarters, every quarter, I'll give you 3 units of credit, and you write another chapter of the book, and when we're all done, we'll put it together, and this can be your thesis. And I said, oh, no, stay away from me with that idea. Because I presumed, I mean, you know how that book is written.
Sure.
It was written that way from the beginning. There were gags, there were puns, there were contractions, there were sentence fragments. And that's the way I wanted to do the book.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't seem to me that there was any other way to do it.
Yeah, you can't write about the Marx Brothers and not be entertaining writing about them. I mean, it's not...
Well...
It doesn't fit.
It sort of evolved that way. In other words, you know, Howard went over that chapter with me, and he said, now this stretch in here, this is not funny at all. Well, I wasn't trying to be funny with every single paragraph, but I mean, he really put me on, you know, he
sure.
just said, you know, we're not fooling around with any of this, you know. But what he liked about it was, in other words, it had this very informal, crazy kind of surface style, but at the heart of it, everything was fully researched and accurate. And it was that way from the beginning, and that's what he liked about it. He said, you got to stick with that. But he did have he did have problems with some of the things I did. In other words, I fabricated dialogues. Some of those fabricated dialogues are still in there. It was based on what Arthur Marx had said and what Harry Ruby had said, so I just kind of made up what I thought people probably said. But I wouldn't put gags in there that Howard thought I couldn't get away with. The only one I remember is when they were talking about making the film palatable for a mass audience. In other words, at that time, Marx Brothers fans liked Marx Brothers movies, and other people stayed away.
Sure.
And Thalberg said, we can't go on that basis. We've got to broaden the appeal. And I said, Groucho threw up his hands, having just swallowed them an hour before. And I said, you can't do that. So, I mean, there's no totally preposterous things like that in there, no completely silly.
Yeah.
The jokes are jokes that would make some kind of sense.
Sure.
And if somebody said something funny, I would try to build up the story and make it work, you know.
Yeah.
So it's funny in that way, and stuff that wasn't funny, he didn't think should go in there. So, and, you know, how many schools could you have turned in something like this, Night at the Opera chapter, and gotten that kind of reaction?
Well, sure.
I mean, if I'd been at any of the Ivy League schools or something, they would have said, well, look, come on. I can't give you 3 units for this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, you're not doing it. You're not getting a master. And so that's what I was afraid was going to happen if this became my master's thesis.
Yeah.
I said, no, I want to write it this way. It's got to be. And Howard said, you know, I imagined college professors as out of the Horse Feathers chorus line, you know,
sure.
with beards and wearing their cap and gown, going, no, no, blue penciling everything in on the page, you know. And he said, Joe, I'll be the head of your thesis committee, and there won't be anybody, and I'll stock the thesis committee with people who would be sympathetic to what you're trying to do. And sure enough, the thing is, Howard Suber said in his house, we had several meetings at his house in December of 67, and he said, you were going to do this, 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 and this, and he promised that he would steer me through the bureaucracy of UCLA so that I'd end up with a book that would be mine. The thing is, this was submitted and it was my thesis, and yet if I made any money out of it, it was completely mine. UCLA never claimed a penny.
Yeah.
And never got a penny out of anything. But he was as good as his word. For 3 years, he pursued it, and he did exactly what he said he was going to do. And that's how the book got written.
Now, where else were you researching it? And Because in those days, there weren't all the research facilities that we now have. Did the Academy already have the Paramount papers, for instance?
No.
No, but it did have some things. It had a continuity script for Duck Soup, which is why when I get to Duck Soup, I say, you know, the Minister of Finance says such and such.
Yeah.
Because it's right there in the continuity script, exactly who it is that's speaking. All you see when you see the room is, you know, a bunch of actors saying their lines. You're not sure who is which, except the guy who quits, I guess, is the Secretary of War, and that's the one that Groucho replaces with Chico. Other than that, I don't know how you would do that. But and you cannot now, and you could not then, copy scripts at the Academy Library.
Sure.
You couldn't Xerox them. But no one had any objection to my coming in and copying it all down.
Sure.
And I copied that down from beginning to end.
I've done it with a laptop.
Well, I didn't have a laptop, but I had NoteHand, which is a form of Greg shorthand, which I had learned in school. I thought when I got to college, I was never going to survive it unless I could write down every word of every lecture.
Yeah.
So I figured I better take this course. And since taking that course, I've never met anyone else who took it. Yeah, so people say, do you know shorthand? The answer is yes and no.
Kind of.
Because shorthand is a two-year course, and I don't know the whole two. And it's designed not for students, but it's designed only for transcribing. This is difficult to explain, but without going into too much detail about it. Apparently, it's no good for reading. You can't read that stuff. You know, the people who write things down in shorthand, they can transcribe it. They can look at it and know what to type, word by word. But if you ask them to sit down and read it, they would kind of be at a loss. We had to learn to read our own notes.
Wow.
Because that's all you got. And the book was written in NoteHand. Didn't have a computer. There was no word processing. And I don't like working at a typewriter. So I would essentially write it on paper in NoteHand and then go type up what I had written.
But so, you didn't have access to studio production records or...
Yeah.
Or the trades
bit
of the time?
Did you have? I asked George Seton so many times what was in those 18 scripts. He was very proud of the fact that they wrote 18 scripts for Day at the Races before that. Because that's what MGM was like. You'd write one draft and they go, that's good. You know, move the whole thing to Saratoga and start over.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was taking place in a hospital or sanitarium, but the idea that it's right next to a racetrack, that happened later. I asked him so many times, he said, let me call them. Let me call MGM. And he called them up, and because he was George Seton, he could. And they did it. They pulled all the scripts, everything they had on Day at the Races, out of the vault, put it in an empty office, and let me come in and read it for one day.
Wow.
And it's a good thing I knew NoteHand, because knowing NoteHand, if I saw something that was interesting, I wrote it down. But, I mean, I speed-read those things. I didn't go to lunch, and I took a lot of notes. And that was in the early months of 1968. And when I got to the studio, so the big sign that they used to have that said MGM, where they had the lion, it would sometimes announce their next film. It was now announcing 2001 A Space Odyssey, which was supposed to come out in 67 and didn't. So I was always wondering what was going to happen with this. So to go to set foot on the MGM lot, that was a thrill. To see these Day at the Races scripts was a thrill. And then to realize 2001 was going to open in April, it was a day I'll never forget. Now the second chapter I turn in has got all this material on what Seton and Pyrosh wrote, plus the fact that they did another tour. I mean, I did the whole, everything I'd done for Night at the Opera, I did on Day at the Races. Howard Suber liked that one better than he liked the Night at the Opera chapter, you know what I mean? So, I mean, I was really doing well. Later, I roomed with a guy named Michael Barlow, who is a name you can look that one up on the IMDb now. He's worked on a lot of stuff, but he's been a good friend and advisor. And he worked at the American Film Institute at the time. And I was able to go see screenings at Greystone. in my last year of doing this, but he met somebody in the MGM script department, and he said, is there anything you want to see in the MGM script department? The guy said he'd open up the vaults again, and I said, I want to see everything they've got on Night at the Opera. So that's how I saw that. But it really was Catch as Catch Can. Irving Brecker showed me all of his scripts. And that was after the one session I had with him. I called him up again. And I said, you know, I had seen the bound scripts, I guess. And he let me go through them. And he gave me more than one day. I mean, I had a little more time to go through his stuff.
So basically the background material on the production of the films mostly comes from interviews.
Yes. Okay. And most of my interview subjects were the writers.
Yeah.
And it was so much the writers, that the exception to that was George Folsey, who was cameraman on mm-hmm. Coconuts and Animal Crackers. And he told me an amazing thing after giving me all this incredible stuff. He said, you know, that Alan Iles book, I sent him a letter and I told him everything I just told you. So the amazing thing is that Alan Iles, who has got nothing on the making of any of those films,
wow.
actually had that material in front of him and didn't use it. Well, the only thing that makes it credible in the slightest is, what's he going to do? Suddenly, Coconuts and Animal Crackers, you've got all these details, and then you go on to Night at the Opera, and there's nothing.
Yeah.
But he kind of made no effort. It was mostly writers, and I saw a lot of scripts. I still have never seen production reports on Marx Brothers films, except for Love Happy. We have all the production reports for Love Happy at the library, well, of all the pictures, I mean.
In the Paramount papers, there aren't production reports for Duck Soup and Feathers and so on?
No. Interestingly, 1 year later, you can find them for good W.C. Fields films like Man on the Flying Trapeze.
Yeah.
And I think It's a Gift. The production reports are a little bit sketchy, but they really tell you a lot.
Oh, I found some incredibly in-depth ones on some projects, yeah. But somebody must have taken the Marx Brothers ones then, do you think?
No, because there aren't... In other words, at a certain point, they do house cleaning, and stuff gets pitched. And obviously, there's nothing from 32 or 33 much that I can find. Million Dollar Legs, I looked, and there's nothing for that. You know, very little. What they have is schedules. There's two schedules for Monkey Business, and I'm able to piece together from that... They did one schedule laying out, here's what we plan to do, you know. And then toward the end, they did a revised schedule for the last 2 weeks. Well, now you can see exactly how far they are behind. And all people talk about, oh, God, you can't stay on a schedule with the Marx Brothers. They were like 2 or 3 days behind schedule, which is very normal.
Yeah.
Very, very typical.
Normal for anybody, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, and Harpo's widow, I talked to, finally, she was one of the last interview subjects I did, and she said, well, you don't dare cause delays in production. Mm. So I think they did here and there, but I think they, you know, you learn quickly if you're, they were quick studies.
They weren't Judy Garland.
Or Marilyn Monroe.
No.
But apparently Zeppo, supposedly on the set of Monkey Business, said, are you going to be needing me in the next little bit? And Charles Barton or somebody said, I guess not. Why? He said, I thought I'd go up to San Francisco. Well, he didn't have that much time. You know, San Francisco is not a half hour's drive from here, which is what people think.
Yeah.
People think that, oh, you can just bop up to, you know, if you don't live in California, it's easy to, you know, on a map, it's just a couple inches. But I think they learned you just don't do that. And Chico was really hard to corral, but sooner or later. I think Buster Keaton said it was an event when you had all three Marx Brothers on the set at the same time. But it did happen. And if you look at those pictures, most of the scenes do not have all three or four Marx Brothers in them. Most of the scenes are, you know, Chico and Harpo. Maybe Harpo by himself, Groucho by himself. It's, you know.
I've always figured those were constructed specifically for that reason, just so they wouldn't have to deal with all of them at the same time.
Could have been. Well, Monkey Business was the first original, and S.J. Perlman and Will Johnstone were strangers to the film production process at that time. But they knew the format, and the format is Groucho has scenes by himself. Chico and Harpo have scenes. Harpo has his harp solo. You have the format going from the stage days, and it sort of lends itself to all the schedules I've seen start with Groucho's entrance. And the schedule to Monkey Business, the first thing they shoot is the four of them in the barrels in the hold. And what you would want to do is schedule it so that all the scenes with the three of them or the four of them are scheduled very early in the schedule. And then if you're having trouble finding Chico, you've got something you can fall back on. You can shoot Groucho's entrance or whatever, or Groucho's scene with Alky Briggs or something. But, you know, you've got to kind of stick to the schedule. Groucho read the book. You know, I kept trying. And, you know, I had, by the time I was finished, you know, Nat Perrin, Robert Pyrosh sent me a letter. I never interviewed him, but George Seton contacted him. And I sent him stuff. He liked it. Arthur Sheikman was high on what I'd written. And friends of Groucho liked what I was doing and told him about it. And he said, and his reaction was, yeah, I heard that. Okay, you know. So I finally sent him a thing and a little questionnaire for him to fill out. And I just had blanks for him to check off, you know, did he like it? He liked it. He didn't like it. He wanted to straighten me out on a few things. He wanted me to leave him alone. And all he did was check that he thought it was good. And then I had, you know, bad, despicable, something. And then I said, none of the above. And he checked none of the above, meaning, well, I meant for that to refer to good also. Sure. So thing can't be good and none of the above, but he meant none of those negative things, I guess. But he gave me his autograph, and I didn't leave a blank for him to sign it, you know. And he was kindly toward the project, but it didn't look like he was ever going to agree to an interview. After a while, it became clear that the book did not depend on my interviewing Groucho Marx. I tried to interview Zeppo also, and Zeppo sent my letter, you know, they sort of answer your letter on the letter and use the return envelope and just send it back. And his response was, Groucho's your man. You want to get a hold of him. Well, that was helpful.
Gummo was still alive at that point, too, wasn't he?
It never occurred to me to try him, and he was such a nice guy that he probably would have, probably would have talked to me, and B, might have interceded with Groucho for me. That never occurred to me. Never occurred to me before just now.
I got a million examples of that in my own life, of something that was staring me right in the face for a project, and I just didn't see it. So many frustrating things. But anyway.
That's a good thought.
Yes.
So when the book came out, part of its, you know, I hoped it would make a big splash. And it got some very good reviews, but a lot of its thunder was stolen by a Richard Anoboli book called The Marx Brothers Scrapbook.
Sure.
The way this impacted Groucho was that The Marx Brothers Scrapbook, which he knew about more than he was more actively involved with. I mean, he would just went and got Groucho with a tape recorder, stuck a microphone in front of him, just like I've got a microphone in front of me right now, and took pictures of him that way. But he was very upset. It was one of the, you know, I mean, you know, I think you know what happened. That he used four-letter words and assumed that they would be excised, and they were printed just the way he had said it. A lot of things he didn't think he'd actually said that ended up in the thing. So it was not just unexpurgated, you know.
Yeah.
But it was very badly transcribed, and it upset him very much. Aaron Fleming said he would wake up in the middle of the night and say, I couldn't have said that. My book came along, and he liked it. You know, he read very quickly, so he probably read my book in an hour or two. And it really took the bad taste out of his mouth. But it took Aaron Fleming's intercession. And I still wanted to ask him these questions. And the thing is, I got two sessions with him, and he was completely unhelpful. I got wonderful funny lines, you know. And no help whatsoever. Not only did I get no new information, but some of the information that I had, it was right there in the book, but he didn't react to it in the book. But when I said, gee, for that whole period, you went to the East and formed Marx Brothers Incorporated, and he just refused to believe that that had happened. Well, I know now there's much more source material for that. Paul Wesolowski has dug up 100 articles in many New York papers and other papers, and they talked to Chico and Harpo as well as Groucho, and they were not going to deliver that fifth film for Paramount. You know, they were out of there. And they were finally convinced they were going to have to come back, and they finally did it. But he had forgotten all that, and he wasn't going to accept it from me that it had actually happened. But I'll tell you what I thought was the funniest part of the interview, because he did level with you, as I said. And I was talking about the vaudeville years, and he said, yeah, and we never fought all the years we were together. You know, Martin and Lewis had so many fights, they kept breaking up, and it was just in his mind that they had gone through all this stuff together and just hadn't gone through that kind of turmoil. And I knew, by then I had read in one of the sources, you know, how they had arguments, was that how they settled arguments was that Chico would believe one thing and Groucho would believe something else. Chico was always ready to do the late whatever idea occurred to him, or he'd have another script. He said, we got to use this script, it's funnier. Groucho would just go, no, let's. Chico would say yes, Groucho would say no. They'd argue for hours, and Harpo would say nothing, but he'd listen to both of them. And after perhaps days of this discussion, Harpo would go, Groucho's right, or Chico was right. Mm-hmm. But whatever he said, that was the end of the argument. Because now it's two against one, and the other guy can't say anything. And I thought I could maybe get him to talk about that. So I said, how did you handle it when you did have disagreements? He said, we hit each other. I always carried a baseball bat with me. So he was going to be Groucho. You know? Yeah. And it was fun, but I didn't get any information out of it.
Now, haven't you been revising that book?
Yeah, I had a deal to do a revision, but the guy finally realized he was too old to stay in the publishing business, and it was taking me too long to do. I've got a full-time job, and I was able to get one session a week into going through whatever new material I had. And it's like I went to Paul Wesolowski, and I said, I know you've got tons of stuff on the Marx Brothers. Could you give me access to it, because I want to revise my book. He threw open all his material to me. I went to Bob Whitey, who had produced our documentary, The Marx Brothers in a Nutshell, and I said, we got a lot of interview stuff in there that never made it into the show. Even the stuff that did make it into the show is not in my book, and I want it to be part of the revision. He gave me access to all of that. And that was a lot of material to deal with. Then I started going through the Academy stuff, and I found out we had stuff I had no idea we had. We've got scripts on Night in Casablanca and a complete set of call sheets. No production reports, but call sheets. Now, the call sheets tell you what they thought they were going to do. But when the call sheet says, tomorrow we're going to do scene 25, and scene 25 is then on the next day's call sheet, it's obvious that they didn't finish scene 25 when they thought they were. And so I have a complete history of Night in Casablanca, but it took me a long time to piece that together. And meanwhile, I was supposed to prepare this second version in like 6 months. And I thought I could do it. And he said, and the publisher said, take your time. So I did. And then he got pissed. You know? And he finally said, I'm going to have to sell my business. So, you know, you run the risk of outlasting the company that's got you under contract, you know. And there was nothing I could do about it. I just kept plugging along and finally said, I've sold. But he did not sell my contract when he sold the business, apparently. And he's now died. Very nice guy, but it just didn't work out. I've got other projects ahead of. In other words, rather than just continue the revision of the book, what I want to do is fold all that into the book I'm doing on American film comedy, which definitely includes the Marx Brothers, and now I know a whole lot more about the Marx Brothers, even than I knew in the 60s.
I would hope so.
But in the 60s, I mean, in other words, all over UCLA Film School, people were aware that I was doing this thing and interviewing people who'd worked with the Marx Brothers. And, you know, it was a big deal then to be doing that. Then the book comes out, and people like Paul Wesolowski says, well, he should have done this, and he should have done that, you know. Yeah. And there's more work. I mean, the Marx Brothers scrapbook has got great stuff in it.
Yeah.
And I would definitely incorporate that as much as I could.
Sure.
So.
Well, I hope it'll come out in some form. I'd love to see all this extra stuff. But even if it doesn't, the original book is a classic. And I love it. And I've always gotten a big kick out of reading that book.
I really appreciate that. And I appreciate it every time I hear it. And I still hear it.
Well, you should hear it every day. It's a terrific book.
I wrote that book between 1967 and 1970. And in 1970, I thought I had finished it.
Nothing's ever finished.
It took 3 years to get it into print. I didn't realize what an arduous process it was going to be. But it took 3 years to get it into print. I thought it would make it made kind of a splash. Then it came out in paperback and had a very long paperback life from 1974 until 1990. And finally, the revenues by 1990 dipped below a certain line that they had at Simon & Schuster, and that was it. So it's been out of print since then, and I would like to get it back into print, but getting it back into print means reviving the issue. Do we do a reprint of the book as it stands? Do we bring it up to date? I was going to write an update section and put it at the end, but we got into revising the whole Verschlugener book. I've got like one page of revised copy of just how the revision would read, incorporating the new stuff. You know? Yeah. Hector Arce's book had new stuff. That was largely from Paul Wesolowski's library. Paul Wesolowski, before ProQuest, used computers to just go, and he found every article in every East Coast publication that he could get hold of. And there's a lot of stuff in there.
How did the Tex Avery project occur to you?
We need to backtrack to... Let's backtrack to when I'm a kid going to the movies. Every Saturday matinee would be an Abbott and Costello feature or something, and five color cartoons. I used to wonder why they bothered to say color. Weren't all cartoons in color? I didn't realize that some of them had been made in black and white, but from 1943 on, they were all color. Even the Terry Toons, and Paul Terry did not want to go to color.
Sure.
But he had to. I learned then as a child, I know I saw King Size Canary when I was in the second grade. I know now what I was seeing was reissue prints. But we picked up on the fact that the new cartoons all had the UPA kind of look. And if it didn't have the UPA kind of look, we knew it was an older cartoon. But older than 1940, you just didn't see very much once in a while. And those were like insufferable.
Sure.
But I picked up on... I know I saw Counterfeit Cat. I saw Senor Droopy, Drag-Along Droopy, mm-hmm. Billy Boy. And some of these things I was seeing when they were new, some of them I was seeing in reissue prints. And I figured out, if you can see an MGM cartoon that doesn't have Tom and Jerry in it, I mean, the Tom and Jerry's were fine, but the non-Tom and Jerry's, holy smoke. And they have Tex Avery's name on them, clear as a bell, but I didn't pick that up. And I read the credits, but I just didn't get, because you'd have the title and directed by Tex Avery, and it was too much. We all assumed that Fred Quimby, who got the credit just before the fade-out, we all presumed that he made those pictures.
Yeah, that's logical.
Shortly after I'd got started on the Marx Brothers book and was talking to Howard Super, who now has a couple books out on his own, and they're quite good. But he wanted to do an oral history program. And he said, I want you to think of something you want to research besides the Marx Brothers. I have this other project in mind. I want you to be part of it. And I said, well, if I'm going to research anything besides the Marx Brothers, I think it should be animation. And he turned a kind of gray color. And his thought was, not animated cartoons. I'm talking about film history. Because in those days, if it was not Disney, it was not a film.
Yeah. You know?
If it was not Disney, no animated cartoon was in serious contention for anything. But, in fact, he had spoken to Lawrence Kilty, I think his name was, who was then head of the Animators Union. And he had told him he was going to do this oral history program. He was going to have students interview Hollywood veterans. And he had encouraged him to consider animators. So he was kind of torn between, no, not animated cartoons, and, well, maybe we should talk to Lawrence Kildee. And we went and talked to him, and he said, yeah, and here's who you should talk to. And he rattled off five people, five names: Dick Humor, Dave Fleischer, Friz Freleng, Tex Avery, Ub Iwerks. Now, I still hadn't connected Tex Avery with Counterfeit Cat and these other things. Now, I'm skipping one. This one is incredibly important, because this is what jumped into my head as soon as he said, I want you to think of something else to research. And that is, about 1962, it's a hot, humid summer, and my mother says, look, will you take your sister to the movies? There's a matinee that I think she'd like, and I'll pay for it if you will take her. You know, she just wanted me to take my little sister off her hands for a couple hours. And my thought was, 2 hours of air-conditioned comfort in a movie theater for free? I'm your man. And I resisted, because the feature was just something I was not interested in at all. But she paid for me to bring Jack Graham along with me, and I figured there might be a good cartoon. There were five cartoons. One of them was Little Rural Riding Hood.
Ah.
Now, I'm now 16 years old. Everyone else, and Jack...
That's friend, a life changer.
My friend Jack is 16, too. Yeah, now we'd seen Tex Avery cartoons before, but we had never made the connection. But I knew it was MGM and it wasn't Tom and Jerry, so it could be good. So I wasn't totally surprised. Jack just about fell out of his chair. And the thing is, everybody else in the theater is like 5 years old or younger. I mean, there were no other teenagers there. There were no adults there. There was nobody who got Little Rural Riding Hood except Jack and me. And we were in hysterics. And my sister and everybody else were just watching a cartoon.
Yeah.
They had no idea what was happening. And I flipped, but I knew this was right in line with King Size Canary and things I'd already seen. And so when I went to UCLA Film School, I still had this memory that there's great cartoons like Little Rural Riding Hood out there. The title was in my head, and King Size Canary I remembered. But other than that, I hadn't really made the connection. The fifth name was Ub Iwerks. And we sent letters to all of them. And Dick Humor, Dave Fleischer, and Friz Freleng all responded. I started interviewing them. Ub Iwerks never responded. Tex never responded. We sent follow-up letters saying, we haven't heard from you. We'd like to do this. Could you please let us know? Blah, blah, blah. Nothing. And, you know, I'm interviewing Friz Freleng, and I kind of would like to see some of his pictures. He's speaking in generalities, and I need to see some Friz Freleng cartoons, which I'm sure I had seen, but the Friz Freleng cartoons and Chuck Jones cartoons were all mixed up in my head.
Sure.
But there was no way, just like there was no way to screen Marx Brothers films. You know, there was no avenue. One of the women at the theater arts department had worked at MGM, and she had a connection there. And she said, give me titles. I can screen anything you want to screen of MGM, I want. And we were going to screen MGM cartoons in preparation for the Tex Avery oral history. But Tex Avery never responded. So she called me about this and said, do you want to do these MGM screenings? And again, my first thought was no, just like, no, I'm not going to subject myself to torture by Groucho Marx. No, Tex Avery never responded. And then I thought, who am I to refuse 25 MGM cartoons for free? And I got to pick them. Now, what am I going on? There's no books.
Sure.
Except Ralph Stevenson's book. And I'm digging around for titles. But Ralph Stevenson's book did say, and he's very contemptuous of what he calls the Tex Avery School of Violence. And he says, yeah, Tex Avery did gags like a kangaroo jumping into its own pocket and disappearing. And I realized I had seen that cartoon. Wait a minute. You know, and he's describing things, and it's like, wait a minute. So I'm trying to find, but there was no place to get a Tex Avery filmography. I looked in the copyright catalog, and any MGM title that had Droopy in it, or, you know, Little Rural Riding Hood, I looked, and that was there. I put that on the list. And things I thought, I think this might qualify. I just put anything down. Out of 25 cartoons, about 17 of them turned out to be Tex Avery's. I only missed on about 8. And they were fun to see. And they all came at the end. Yeah. So we had this incredible screening of... The first picture on the screen was Flea Circus. I went with Lindsay Duran, who is now known as the producer of Sense and Sensibility. Mm-hmm. She was then just another film student, you know. The both of us just fell down, just like Jack Graham and me watching Little Rural Riding Hood. Flea Circus starts, and they're handing out magnifying glasses to the audience. And we just started falling down, laughing. And, I mean, you know, full-throated laughter out of adults. and supposedly it's just animated cartoons. It was incredible. And then the 7 non-Tex Averys dribbled in at the end. It was like, okay. But I knew now this was a subject that I had to pursue. And it took me a year to find Tex Avery. But I found him. I was taking the animation classes, which were taught by a guy named William Shull. And Tex Avery's name never came up. He talked about Disney. He talked about even Walter Lantz's name came up. But he never mentioned Tex Avery. I never put two and two together that William Shull might know how to contact Tex Avery. I'm just following every lead I can, trying to figure out how to reach Tex Avery and say, can we do these interviews? You know, get him on the phone, maybe, but he's not answering the letters. And I was getting in trouble because I was supposed to make an animated film, and I was getting 3 units, and I was all involved in the Marx Brothers, and I was not producing this film. So I had a meeting with Bill Shull at his house, and it was a very cordial meeting. He was a very nice guy. And, you know, we decided what we were going to do about the film. Okay. He was going to give me an incomplete, and I was going to try and finish it and then, you know, get these 3 hours credits. And just very conversationally, he says, what else are you doing? And I said, well, I'm writing this thing on the Marx Brothers, and I'm trying to find a guy named Tex Avery. Oh, yeah, Tex Avery. Yeah, he's at Cascade now, isn't he? And it's, I didn't realize. You know, animation was such a small world. They all knew where each other was. They didn't talk every day, but, I mean, I didn't realize. Now, Bill Shull is one of the animators on Bad Luck Blackie.
Wow.
Which I had not even seen or heard of, but, you know, and he's not credited, but I've seen the sheets, and he did a couple scenes. Maybe he was working his way up from assistant to full-fledged animator. He is credited on some of the later pictures. So he'd worked for Tex Avery. He knew right where he was. I said, what's Cascade? He says, it's a studio. I said, how do I contact that? He said, you can look it up. And sure enough, I looked it up. And after everything I'd gone through with George Seton, I figured, all right, I know what this is going to be like. It's going to take me months to actually get an audience with Tex Avery. So I figured, if it's going to take me that long, I better start now. So I bit the bullet, dialed the number for Cascade Studios, and I just said, I better get this process in motion. The operator answers, Cascade Studios. I said, yes, hello. I'm trying to reach Mr. Tex Avery. And the operator said one word. And the one word was, just a moment, I'll connect you. I mean, my heart jumped into my throat. You know, I admired this guy so much. And the idea that I was going to speak to him, if he had been like George Seton, that would have been difficult. But I knew nothing about George Seton before all that stuff. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Except they'd worked on Day at the Races. But Tex Avery, my God, he was... to me, one of the greatest talents in all of filmmaking. And the idea that he was going to come on the phone in a second, there was no assistant or anything. So pretty soon I was talking to him, and I managed to get it out, what I wanted to do. And he was such a nice guy. He just said, all right, well, let's see if we can work this out. And I had a session with him. There was going to be a second year of the oral history program. So I had a session with Tex, and then it turned out the second year got canceled. So there was no second year, and I tried to get funding for a Tex Avery oral history from the American Film Institute or something, and just struck out. Finally, I said, all right, I'll do a second session with Tex. I'll get an article out of it. It'll just be an interview thing. I'll be able to sell it to a film magazine, but this should be done. And Tex went along with it. And it all went out from there. And trying to sell the article, I tried Ian Cameron, who was the editor of Movie Magazine. And he said, well, we don't pay for articles, but I am interested. I also run a series of books. He had published the John Ford book by Peter Bogdanovich, yeah. You know. And he said, I'm very interested in doing an interview book of Friz Freleng, Tex Avery, and Chuck Jones. How would you like to do it? And it was sort of in the air for a while. I started teaching at Penn State. I was going with Lindsay Duran, broke up with her, started going with her again. She went to London to try to work with Stanley Kubrick and Richard Lester. That didn't work out. Now she's hanging on in London. And we were in touch, and she said, why don't you come visit me over Christmas? And you can get a flight through Icelandic Airlines. It won't cost you very much. And I'm now teaching. I'm making thousands of dollars a year. I've got a real job, you know. So I could actually afford to do this. So now I'm in London. While I was in London, I had a meeting with Ian Cameron, and we worked it out. Let's do the book. And he said, can you deliver it in 9 months? I think he wanted me to deliver it in 6 months. I said, come on, I'm teaching. Give me 9 months at least. And that would have made it finished in September. It was actually December, but that's how I finished it. And by the time I finished it, things were rocky, and there was an October revolution at November Books. And finally they closed up, and they closed up as the manuscript was at the typesetters. And the typesetter held on to the manuscript and the galleys. I had a carbon, but they were holding on to what they had in the hopes of getting some money. And they finally realized, you're not going to get any money from us. You might as well give us the stuff back. And they didn't want it. So I still have the galleys that were wow. The first galleys that were printed out for that. So the book was now mine, and I sold it to Leonard Maltin. And so it finally came out. But, I mean, all that was happening while I was trying to finish the Marx Brothers book.
How did you find Tex? Because I've interviewed a lot of people, as have you, and a lot of times they are not as aware of the impact of their work as we would think they would be. And I would guess in a career like his, when he did not get a lot of praise for being a great filmmaker, that maybe he didn't quite see it. Or did he?
He didn't, and he was really kind of the forgotten man there. He'd been doing commercials, and he won some awards for his commercials. But he actually said, I think in that first session, that once in a while his daughter or son would be watching cartoons on television, and one of his would come on, and they'd call and say, hey, Tex, isn't this one of yours? Or Dad or something, you know? They'd put the phone up to the speaker. He'd say, yeah, I think so. You know, turn it off. He thought it was ancient history and that nobody was interested. And he was surprised that I was interested. And but he was so agreeable. One of his friends who I've talked to after he died said he just wanted to make everybody happy. And it was a matter of scheduling the interviews. He would say, call me on Tuesday. You know, call me Tuesday of next week. And I would clear the day and call him and be ready to do an interview. And he'd say, we're in trouble, Joe. We're in trouble. And something had come up, and he had to finish a commercial or finish some work and couldn't do it. We'd reschedule it, and we might reschedule it a couple of times, but he would always eventually do it. And the final book is based on only three interviews.
Wow.
I did a third interview with him after getting the deal. But the first interview was supposed to be for the oral history program, but it wasn't. There was no such thing. The second interview was to do the article, and I tried to cover his whole career. We'd only talked about a few random things in the first session. And by the third session, I knew his pictures backward and forward, you know. And I had really detailed questions for him, and they kind of threw him. It was a little bit too much. Hmm. And he was a little ticked off at me. But that never lasted with him. You know, he always got over it. And his son died while I was going through all this.
Oh.
And it was very tragic. He was like 21. I mean, he was, you know, just exactly the wrong thing to happen. He OD'd.
Oh, man.
His daughter is still alive and has a couple of kids, and they're grown up now.
Hmm.
But I didn't meet any of them then, but I just... You know, I was making a film, trying to get the Marx Brothers book into print, and then trying to do this book on Tex Avery, and I just, you know, I didn't know how to respond. So I never called him, and we talked about it later, and it had all blown over. He had a divorce. His wife divorced him. They finally just couldn't stay together. They were not doing well. But then they couldn't stay together. So at the end of 1974, he was given an award by ACIFA, the Annie Award, which is now given every year. But sure. it was pretty new at that point. It was only the second or third time they did it. And they gave awards to exactly the threesome that Ian Cameron wanted to do, Friz Freleng, Chuck Jones, and Tex Avery. And I was in the act of wrapping things up in Pennsylvania, coming back out here. And I got out here just about in time. I think I arrived that day and went that night to Sherman Oaks and attended the dinner and saw the thing, and he got the award. But I was really expecting to see this beaten man. Well, he was a beaten man when I first met him. Now, with all this stuff off of his shoulders, he was as happy as I'd ever seen him.
Wow.
He was suntanned. He'd been deep-sea fishing and... He looked great. He looked happy. He was happy to see Chuck and Friz and trade stories with them. And he just was as happy as I've ever seen him. And I had a couple dealings with him about doing the book. And he said, at the end of one of our sessions, he said, well, you know, drop in when you're in town. I finally got a place in Malibu, so I wasn't in Hollywood a lot. But when I was, I tried to visit him. And we really were friends. By the time he died, we really were friends. And it was incredible to be friends with this guy that I admired more than anyone else. I mean...
I can't even imagine it. Yeah, I nearly worship that guy. I mean, and have as long as I've known his name, which is a long time.
Did the book help you to introduce... Did the book help to introduce you to who he was and what he had done? Or had you figured it out already?
Yeah, I was already a fan of his, and I was a film collector at that point, so I already had 16mm prints of maybe 20 of the films. So it came along just about that time. What got me into him was I used to, when I was a kid, would watch the Woody Woodpecker show, and Walter Lantz would do the intros, and they would almost always have an Avery on there. And the one, or, you know, one of the Lance Averys. And there was one called Crazy Mixed Up Pup that just killed me. It just killed me. And they showed it frequently enough that I got to really know it very well. And a good friend of mine, my lifelong friend, and I still will, when we see each other, we'll say, "Hey, Maggie, I can't eat this slop." So it stuck with us forever, you know.
The amazing
thing
about
kid.
Amazing thing about that picture to me is, you get as soon as he set up the situation, you get it.
Yeah,
and you think, well, all right, this is going to be predictable, and then he gets away with it.
Yeah,
he keeps surprising you. He keeps doing things you don't expect, and at one point, Maggie is kind of edging her way past the dog. She's not sure what he's going to do, and he just gets up and does a little vaudeville dance.
Yep.
And jumps right back down into the dog position again. Just incredibly funny.
Well, there are his films. I think one of the brilliant things about Tex was that he could mine a specific situation over and over and over, like Deputy Droopy.
Deputy Droopy, they're trying to...
To keep the sheriff from waking up.
Waking up the sheriff.
And
who it turns out is deaf.
Yeah. And but it's the same gag setup with a different payoff, but the same gag setup repeatedly, over and over and over. They go in, Droopy starts to wake him up. They have to stifle the noise or whatever. It just happens, and it's that's the cartoon. And we had friends over at the house one time when we were in East Berlin, Pennsylvania. And it's the only time I ever saw it happen. A guy literally fell out of his seat laughing. Literally fell onto our floor and was just gasping with laughter at Deputy Droopy. So
that's just about what Jack and I did when we saw Little Rural Riding Hood. Can you imagine two teenagers not expecting anything, seeing Little Rural Riding Hood, which I still think is brilliant.
I do too.
And
I think it's funnier than Red Hot Riding Hood, which I think is great.
Which I had already seen.
Yeah.
And that didn't do that much for me, but again, I saw that as a child. But the audience, there were enough bigger kids in the audience to give it a real reaction. And I realize now that's what made it at MGM. That got such a reaction. There was a thing in New Jersey, there was a theater that ran it, and the audience wouldn't let them go on with the show. They demanded they run it again. They ran it a second time, and they still weren't satisfied, and the manager had to come down and say, we'll run it a third time, but some of you want to see the feature. We're going to have to show the feature first, and then we'll run it after that. And they did, and this got in the trades. And I think after that, it was hard for Fred Quimby to say no to Tex Avery, which he did do a few times.
Well, sure.
But for the most part, this is how Tex got away with doing those insane cartoons at the least likely studio for that kind of thing in town.
Earlier we were talking about how people evolve into their characters, Jack Benny and Laurel and Hardy, all mm-hmm. these people who did that.
Yeah.
Tex did it too, because the Warner Brothers stuff, there are some wonderful Warner Brothers cartoons that he did.
Yes.
But by and large, his true greatness is not there. He's a perfectly fine Warner Brothers director, but when he gets to MGM, it turns into something else.
Yes, and that's why it was the MGM cartoons that I knew as a kid, and that's why that was my main focus when I talked to him. But he remembered the Warner Brothers days more fondly, and I think he had more freedom. He said at MGM you had to fight for what you thought was right. But by then he knew what he wanted.
Sure.
Plus, he said they built up to a different style. And I think that takes time, and takes time working with the same people. But they build up to a style where they could go to each cartoon and say, well, we'll do this with what worked before, you know. But now, well, here's a situation we haven't ever done. You know, the ventriloquist cat or something.
Sure.
You know, this is a little bit different. And these are the gags. And, you know, Jack Nicholson was the mail boy for the MGM animation department. And he said Nicholson just loved his stuff. And he said, you know, Nicholson was convinced he was going to be a movie star. And he said, we didn't want to disillusion him.
Yes.
But none of them believed him.
Yeah. Well, he was probably a funny-looking kid. Who knows?
He probably was. Yeah. A skinny kid, and he's no Cary Grant.
Sure.
But, you know, he could do something else. The other, you know, as this idea was percolating in my head, that Tex Avery should be, was a, you know, I was at film school. If he wasn't Sergei Eisenstein or Robert Flaherty, why are you doing a book on him?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? My belief was that the Marx Brothers and Tex Avery were that important and unknown.
Yeah.
You know, it really wasn't known. If you look at the Marx Brothers book, you can see that it's written by a film student saying, look, this scene has meaning.
Sure.
There's a reason this scene works, you know. While I was at UCLA, Pauline Kael came and spoke, and I was teaching assistant for the beginning film class, which was taught by Lou Stoneman, who was an Academy Award-winning documentary maker. And that day, they were going to show Chien de Lu. So I've seen Chien de Lu several times.
Sure.
And he said, Lou Stoneman introducing Pauline Kael said, no, today we're going to see Chien de Lu, which is one of the most incredible films of all time. And we have a wonderful guest here, Miss Pauline Kael. She's a great critic, and she's full of piss and vinegar. And she was quite insulted by that.
Wow.
And she got up and she said, well, I can understand being, you know, attacked for my style by stodgy film publishers and so forth. But, I mean, here in academia, that's kind of a surprise. But she said, but I do agree that Chien de Lu is one of the most remarkable films ever made. And I thought, yeah, okay, Chien de Lu is good. I mean, I think it's great. But Tex Avery made how many cartoons
sure.
that are that surreal?
Yeah.
And they'll work with an audience, whereas you try showing Chien de Lu to an audience. To this day, it still alienates a lot of people.
Well, of course
they're not
going
to
yeah.
get it.
And that was its purpose, too, in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember when I first started taking film seriously or realizing that you could, as a late teenager, early 20s, I found a book called Surrealism in Cinema.
Mm.
And because I'd seen Chien de Lu and other Buñuel things and other Dali things, and so surrealism very, very much appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of outraged reading through this because the name that kept coming up more than any other was Harpo.
Mm.
Because the guy would write about surrealistic things that he did. And I guess I was not in the mood to think about the Marx Brothers as being surrealistic in the same way that Louis Buñuel and Salvador Dali were.
Mm-hmm.
But then it didn't take me long to realize, oh, yeah, absolutely, it's true. It's like, you know, burning the candle at both ends. He's got a candle burning at both ends in his coat, you know.
It's, yeah, yeah. That's,
there are things like, I mean,
part of why I thought it was great. I still think that what makes the Marx Brothers work, it's like, you know, I think Groucho is very talented and Harpo as a solo is marvelous. But the combination, it's like getting all four Beatles.
Sure it is, yeah. It's exactly the same
in one studio at
make.
One
yeah.
time, which they actually did do. is that Groucho will hit you with verbal humor, verbal humor, verbal humor until he wears you out and you don't want to hear another verbal joke. And suddenly Harpo is pulling a candle burning at both ends out of his pocket where the guy asks him, can you help me out? I'd like to get a cup of coffee.
Yep.
And he pulls out the cup of coffee and it's got
and it's
steam
hot.
Coming
yep.
out of it. And it came out of his pocket.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's absolutely remarkable. And
yeah.
yet, you know, just how you would make a movie that was just all Groucho doing that all the
sure.
way through, or Harpo doing that all the way through, I don't know how that would work.
No. And before we end, which we must, I will say that I think Zeppo is much better than people think that he was. I think he was always sharp. He just got bad parts. But I think that he probably could have really been one of them if he had been given better.
Yeah, he
better
said,
roles.
You know, the three of them were kind of what's it called? A triad, a threesome,
a triumvirate.
A triumvirate is the word I think I was trying to go for. They really kept. Remember that Gummo was there.
Yeah.
when they got on the right track comedy wise. Whether it happened in Nacogdoches, Texas or not, we're not sure now.
Sure.
But something happened, and they became a comedy act, and they got something that clicked. Gummo was there, and Zeppo wasn't. So, and Chico wasn't either. But Groucho, Chico, and Harpo became the triumvirate that managed everything else in
yeah.
that troupe, and that included Zeppo. And it was like, no, you're going to do this, and that works.
Yeah, and it's too bad. Well, but he didn't stick around long. But But I like seeing him when he's there.
Well, he was there from like about 1918 all the way up to 1933. Yeah. So it's a pretty long run. And from at least Coconuts, when they started Coconuts in 1925, that contract still exists. And it's got a clause in it saying, if Herbert Marx leaves the act, this is what we'll do. So it was he was threatening wow. that early, at least.
Well, we've got to stop, and I really appreciate this. I've had a great time talking to you, Joe.
And, thank you.
We're both losing our voices, so we need to stop. So thank you very much, Joe. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that talk with Joe Adamson. You know, as long as that interview was, and believe me, we cut it down quite a bit to get it on the air, I might make another episode out of it one of these days. But we never got around to talking about Joe's work at the Academy Library, the Margaret Herrick Library, where he is one of the great staff members who offers so much aid to poor film scholars like myself. He's been of great help to me many times, as has everybody there. If you're writing a book on film history, that's one place that you cannot afford to miss. So maybe we'll talk to Joe again one of these days, and we'll talk about his path to working there at the Academy Library, where he's been for quite a long time, long as I've known him, which has been a long time. Let's not get specific, okay? Come on. Hope you'll visit the website, thecommentarytrack.com. I have all of Joe's books and movies that he's worked on his personal page on the website with Amazon links to all of it, so you can click right through, get all of Joe's books and DVDs, and I'll get a little bit of a kickback, because that's what Amazon does when you go through my website. It'll help keep the lights on here, and I much appreciate that. I want to also remind you that I now have a second podcast called The Commentary Track Presents Radio Movies, or let's keep it short, Radio Movies. As the title suggests, it's radio shows from the 30s and 40s that are based on classic films, and I give a fairly lengthy, I would say sometimes 10 minutes, 12 minutes, introduction on the production of the film. So I thought it was a novel way of addressing film history in another fashion, and I think it's going over well. I've gotten a lot of good response from people on it. So I hope that you will listen to that. My wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, is the announcer both on the commentary track and on Radio Movies, and I want to thank her for that. Also thank James Hutchins for designing my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Visit them both as often as you possibly can. Thanks to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my wonderful theme music. And thanks to you for passing the word along. You know, this cannot build an audience in any other way except by word of mouth. People just have to find the podcast and listen to it and then tell friends who might also be interested. So I would really appreciate it if you would take it upon yourself to mention it to any of your friends who are interested in this kind of thing. There's got to be lots of them out there, right? Got to be lots. So let's help build an audience here and make sure that this podcast survives. I sometimes think we're right on the verge. So let's keep it moving onward and upward. And I thank you very much for doing that. Also go to iTunes, leave a nice review and a 5-star rating. That also helps, because the more reviews and ratings we get, the more visible it is on the iTunes page, and then people will be more likely to find it, and just wheels keep on turning. So I hope that you will go there and do that. Got another good one coming up for you next time. Because it's summer, I'm not saying next week any longer, because frankly, I don't know when the next one will be, but it won't be more than a couple of weeks at most. Things are, you know, it's lazy time, it's summertime, and the living is easy. There are also catfish involved. I forget how. But my daddy ain't rich. Although my mother was good looking. So hush little baby, don't you cry. I can just keep going on. There's no really point to this. So join me next time. And until then, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.